From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet one of the two women who was taken prisoner of war during the Gulf War. Major Rhonda Cornum is a flight surgeon whose helicopter was shot down by Iraqis. She was sexually molested by one of her captors and now finds herself in the middle of a controversy over whether women in the military are more vulnerable than men. Also today, we call the Philippines to speak with one of the country's most respected writers, F. Chenille Jose. He also founded the Philippines chapter of PEN, the International Writers Organization. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood's new Western. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A team of United Nations weapons inspectors has arrived in Baghdad, but won't begin its inspections until Sunday. The team leader, Russian Nikita Smedovich, said his team would delay its visits until after an Iraqi national holiday tomorrow. The delay puts off a potential confrontation between the team and the Iraqi government, which said that inspectors would not be allowed to search government ministry buildings. Before leaving Bahrain for Baghdad today, Smedovich asserted the inspector's right to visit any site, but declined to say what locations the team is planning to search. Today, the Postmaster General announced a complete overhaul of the postal system that will result in the elimination of 30,000 jobs. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The Postal Service is facing a $2 billion deficit and increasing competition from private delivery services such as Federal Express. Under the plan, all employees with 25 years' experience and those 50 years old with 20 years on the job are eligible for a retirement package incentive, which includes a lump sum of 6 months' pay. Postmaster General Marvin Runyon says without cutting costs, postage rates will quickly accelerate.
If we do nothing now, the rates will have to be increased to somewhere between 34 and 35 cents in 1994.
The Postal Service needs 30,000 people to retire. Some 40,000 are expected to take the buyout. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Firefighters are making progress in the West. They've already contained 6 major fires and hope to have several more under control soon. Jill Hoyt reports from member station KBSU in Boise, Idaho.
The Boise Interagency Fire Center says 11 major fires are still burning about 100,000 acres in Idaho, California, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington. The firefighters' success so far is due in part to surplus military aircraft left over from the Cold War. The C-23A plane used to carry jet engines around Europe. Now it carries smoke jumpers. This elite corps of firefighters parachute onto the fringes of smaller fires and put them out before they get big. Fire bosses also are using a Vietnam-era plane that flies low to the ground. It leads large air tankers carrying retardant through smoky canyons. Fire managers are cautiously optimistic that many of the major fires that have burned for a week will be contained soon, weather permitting. For National Public Radio, I'm Jill Hoyt in Boise.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street, but the market showed no clear-cut reaction to news of a slight decline in the unemployment rate for July. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to finish at 3,332. Declines edged advances. This is NPR News. A top campaign aide to President Bush may have stirred up a new controversy today by saying that the president approved of her references to alleged womanizing by Democratic candidate Bill Clinton. Mary Madeline, a deputy manager of the Bush campaign, said that despite his official disavowal, the president was not upset by her personal attack on Clinton's morals. In an interview to be broadcast tomorrow on CNN's Evans and Novak show, Madeline said that the president didn't want her to stop. She said the president hoped her exuberance in defending him in the future would not cross over the line. Madeline said that she had not apologized for the remarks, as a White House statement had said, and had no intention of apologizing. It's been another full day of Olympic competition. From Barcelona, Matt Markowitz reports on the U.S. team results.
Jennifer Capriati of the United States defeated Germany's Steffi Graf in 3 sets to win the women's singles tennis gold medal. Meanwhile, in the last day of wrestling competition, the U.S. captured 2 golds and 1 bronze in the freestyle class. And sisters Karen and Sarah Josephson won first place in the duet category of synchronized swimming. In track and field, Jackie Joyner Kersey failed in her bid for a 2nd gold medal this summer. Joyner Kersey finished 3rd in the long jump, as did runner Lynn Jennings in the 10,000-meter race. Coming up tomorrow, on the 2nd to last day of Olympic competition, there are the finals in the men's 100 and 400-meter relays, the women's 1,500-meter race, and the long-awaited men's basketball finals when the undefeated Dream Team goes against Croatia. For National Public Radio, I'm Matt Markiewicz in Barcelona.
The nation's unemployment rate eased slightly in July, dropping by a tenth of a point to 7.7%. In a separate survey, the government reported an increase of 198,000 in the number of non-farm payroll jobs in July. The Labor Department's report said that the increase in new jobs came mainly in the service sector, and some of it was attributable to federally funded summer youth employment programs. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 2 American women were taken prisoner by the Iraqis during the Gulf War. One of them was my guest, Major Rhonda Cornum. She's a flight surgeon. On February 27, 1991, she was on a search and rescue mission in an Army Black Hawk helicopter. While flying close to the ground, the helicopter was shot down by Iraqis. 5 of the 8 people on the mission were killed in the crash. The injured survivors became POWs. Cornum's injuries were life-threatening, yet even before she received medical attention, she was sexually molested by an Iraqi guard. Major Cornum tells the story of her captivity in the new book, She Went to War. I asked Major Cornum to describe what she was thinking and feeling as her helicopter was fired on.
Like everyone else, I wondered what was going to happen. Luckily, when you're only flying 15 feet above the ground, you're only scared for about 10 seconds, and then you crash. I just wondered if I was going to die in this particular juncture.
Were you afraid of dying?
No, I really wasn't, because I was 36. I'd had a great life. I had done most of the things I thought were important, and I thought I was at least dying for a good cause.
What about, you know, having a husband and a daughter?
Well, I loved them, and I knew they'd be sad, and of course, later, you know, like the next week, I worried about that, but at the time, I knew they would be proud of me.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memory of the plane crashing?
I remember impact, and that's all I remember. The next thing I remember, so obviously after that, it rolled and broke up, and I don't know what else happened, but the next thing I remember, everything had stopped. There was nothing moving, nothing making noise. It was just void.
Now, the way you describe it, when you came to and you were pinned down by a piece of the fuselage, you didn't feel any pain as you were regaining consciousness.
I just laid there, and I really thought maybe I was dead. I didn't know what being dead would feel like, and nothing hurt. You're right, I probably just couldn't, my brain wasn't working very well. But I saw a flame, and I decided, well, if I'm not dead, then I better move so this thing doesn't spread and I die in a post-crash fire. And if I am dead, I'll try to move and nothing will happen, then I'll know. And then, you know, as the seconds wore on and minutes wore on, I guess my brain got working better, and I pushed my way out from under this piece of stuff.
What was the reaction of the Iraqis who found you when they realized that you were a woman, which I don't think they realized right away?
Well, they didn't realize it right away, but when they took my flight, they took all my stuff off, took my gun, my flight back, my flak jacket, my flight vest, and they took my helmet off, and long brown hair, and they pretty much realized then I was female. Other than a little flurry of high volume Arabic, they didn't do anything at that time.
Mm-hmm. What were your injuries?
I broke both my arms between the elbow and the shoulder, so I couldn't use them at all. Blew out all the ligaments in my right knee, so I couldn't walk or pick up my leg very well. I could walk as long as it was in a straight line. Got shot, which I didn't realize at the time, but I knew I was really weak and dizzy and nauseated. So later I found out by various, you know, blood tests that I probably lost almost 50% of my blood volume.
Hmm.
Various other lacerations, cuts, bruises, and a broken finger.
And since you are a flight surgeon, you were trying to diagnose yourself the whole time.
Yeah, well, at first, unfortunately, I thought my arms had been severed. And I was really afraid that when they loosened up my flight suit wrists that my arms would fall off, and I really was afraid I wouldn't handle that very well. I was so happy to realize that they were still attached.
What made you think that they were severed?
Well, I'd been laying under this piece, and basically this piece of the wreck went right over my arms where they were broken, and I had seen that before. I had been in the emergency room one time when they brought in a guy who'd been run over by a truck, and they brought his legs in on one stretcher and him on the other. which that didn't bother me, but when it was myself having to look at that, I wasn't sure how well I would do.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the really excruciating moments in your book is when the Iraqis find you and they lift you out from under the fuselage by grabbing your arm and pulling.
Yeah, that was awful. That's what displaced my broken arm. That was absolutely awful. That was the single most painful moment of the entire week.
And you screamed. Did you feel bad for screaming?
Well, I felt like I wasn't in control when I screamed. I don't like to feel that way, but there was no choice. And luckily, they let go of my arm after they got me up, so it must have worked.
Yeah, right. It's like pain and screaming sometimes has a really practical function.
It really did.
Yeah, and I guess it did in that instance. Someone who survived the crash, as you did, was Sergeant Troy Dunlop, who was 20 years old. And you were taken together on a series of rides by your captors till you were finally taken to the prison in which you were kept. On one of those rides, the guard sitting next to you put a blanket over you, unzipped your flight suit, and manually raped you. Is that an accurate description?
I suppose that's an accurate description. That is a much more dramatic description than I would use, but that certainly is accurate.
What would you say?
I would say manually molested, which seems to have much less emotional connotation.
Mm-hmm. Now, here you were bleeding, you were injured, you couldn't see out of one eye because it was swollen shut. You not only had the broken arms and everything, but one of your fingers was completely smashed. What went through your mind as some guys like fondling you and trying to sexually molest you while you're kind of like barely hanging on?
Yeah, I could have died pretty easily. I was really amazed that he would see me as a sex object at that point. My first thought when he started, and it wasn't just being molested. He started kissing me and kissing my neck, and I thought, he's got to be kidding that he thinks this is a turn on. I was just amazed. I don't know what else to say than that.
Well, I was amazed too. I mean, you just wonder, like, what can go through somebody's mind that I mean,
I don't know. And he obviously, because when he did try to get my flight suit off, and he stopped when I did scream because it was excruciating, trying to pull this thing over my broken arms. So he wasn't doing it, I don't think, just to be brutal. I mean, I think he was doing it for his own sexual gratification. But for that to be gratifying, I thought was a remarkable thing.
As you know, some people have used this incident as an example of why women shouldn't be allowed in combat because they can be sexually molested, which would make them more vulnerable. How do you react to that?
Well, this was such, compared to the other things that happened, I just lost 5 crew members in a horrible wreck. I'd been shot and I'd had a lot of bones broken and wasn't sure I was going to make it. So what this guy did was really an insignificantly, in the hierarchy of things that could happen, that was really an insignificant event. It was just remarkably, I just was amazed he would do it, but it certainly didn't convince me, I shouldn't be here.
In your book, you say that your biggest fear wasn't being raped, but that Dunlop, the survivor, the American survivor with you in the truck, would do something stupid to protect you and that he would get shot. So you were actually very worried about him, and you point out that you were 37, he was 20, which made you just about old enough to be his mother.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was, you know, the New York Times reporter, Elaine Shalino, did a piece about you, and she called up him for a quote, and he said that he still thinks that women shouldn't be allowed in combat. And he said, "I worried about her all the time, and being a POW, going through the torture, the pain, you shouldn't also have to worry about what's happening to the female soldier." Did you know he felt that way?
No, I didn't know he felt that way at the time. But if you, I'm not sure if it's in the New York Times piece, but certainly in an interview we did with Jane Pauley, she asked him, does he feel the same? And he said, yeah, I don't think women should go to combat. And he said, well, how about Major Cornum? And he said, yeah, I'll go to war with her anytime. So people can, by their experiences, certainly make exceptions for individuals, if not for a population.
Now, what's your attitude about men who feel that they're supposed to have a greater responsibility to women than they would to men? Do you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. I think that is a cultural thing, and I don't have any problem with that in our culture. I don't mind men opening the door for me. I always say thank you. I think that, yep, guys should stand up and give their seats to little old ladies to get on the bus, and I do that too. I think in the workplace, we should be treated as equals. I think the military is a profession.
Mm-hmm. So to someone like Sergeant Dunlop, you would say that he shouldn't feel that he has a special responsibility
I think training
to a woman soldier, yeah.
Right. I think training would prevent that. Mm-hmm. Certainly in our unit, we didn't see men just flocking to hold guard positions when the women were assigned out there. The women took their 4 hours like everyone else did.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in Sergeant Dunlap's case, like all infantry guys, they don't have any infantry soldiers. They don't have any infantry officers. And so he's never had experience with women who've been trained to do the kinds of things he might have been trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to feel like they would be a handicap is a reasonable thing for him to feel, I think.
You were interrogated. I mean, it wasn't a brutal interrogation, but, I mean, you were questioned.
Right.
How did you decide what you were going to answer and where you would draw the line?
Well, I knew about the code of conduct, which in general terms says you shouldn't do anything to hurt your fellow captures or to help the enemy. I basically decided that I would tell them the truth if it was obvious anyway. For example, what kind of helicopter were you in? Well, when my wrecked Black Hawk was sitting basically on top of this guy's bunker, it seemed pretty stupid to say I don't know. When asked what unit I was in, when I'm wearing a 229th patch, it seemed pretty obvious I could tell them I was in the 229th. I wasn't giving them any information that they wouldn't have already known. When asked where our unit was or where we were going, I wasn't going to tell them that.
You also didn't tell them that you were a mother. You told them you were married. But when they said, do you have any children, you said no.
Well, I thought that was important because I had some concerns about, first of all, concerns about terrorist groups. I didn't want anything to happen to her, and I had some concerns that they would use that information in a psychological way against me to get me to talk.
You were in an impossibly helpless situation when you were captured because your arms were both broken, so they were useless. You couldn't use them for anything, and if you moved them at all, you were in great pain. One of your legs was pretty useless.
I guess I was pretty useless.
Yeah. Well, you couldn't even get to the bathroom. You needed it very badly. You asked your captors to tell you where it is, and they let you use it, but you couldn't get out of your flight suit in order to be able to relieve yourself. So you were in this really kind of impossible and embarrassing position of having to rely on your male captors to unclothe you so that you could relieve yourself. I was just thinking, like, what a both absurd and awful position to be in.
Yeah, modesty kind of goes out the window when you're in that helpless a position. You just have to you look at your hierarchy of concerns, and modesty was no longer very high on that list.
But it's interesting that when you were finally able to communicate what you needed done, that, I mean, they did it, and they didn't try to take advantage of you while doing it.
No, they certainly didn't. They were very considerate. They had to slice my flight suit off me and peel it off, and they averted their eyes when I was naked and put a robe on top of me and then take me to the bathroom. They were actually pretty nice about it.
Mm-hmm. You know what I found interesting? You know sometimes when you really have a full bladder and all you can think of is, like, relief? And you think, oh, what a really petty, insignificant problem this is in the scheme of things. And I'm reading your book, and here you are just under the worst imaginable circumstances, right? Prisoner of war, broken bones all over the place. And you have a full bladder. And, like, that at that moment is just the most important thing to take care of.
It really is. You do not, you don't want to burst your bladder. That's a medical emergency. And you don't want to live in a wet, smelly flight suit for the rest of your stay, which could be months. So, it takes on a life of its own, that problem.
You know, I was just reading in People magazine that you're planning to do a residency in urology, and I was really wondering if there was any connection.
No, I've wanted to do urology since I was a third-year medical student.
Okay. There's a moment in your book in which you describe the first time you saw yourself in a mirror after you crashed. Describe for us what you saw.
Well, I saw this pretty bedraggled-looking woman with two black eyes, hair that was matted. I was worried about beyond hope. Dirt, blood everywhere. I really looked pretty awful. Then I really was amazed that anybody would have considered me a sex object.
Yeah, right.
But I was relieved. My nose wasn't broken. And usually when I wreck a horse or wreck a truck or something, my nose is the first to hit.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Major Rhonda Cornum, who spent 8 days as a prisoner of war during the Gulf War. And there's a new book about that experience called She Went to War. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Major Rhonda Cornum about her experience as a POW during the Gulf War. How were you released?
There was a prisoner exchange, and I think they brought the first 300 Iraqis back to Baghdad, and then they flew the 29 remaining prisoners out.
When did you allow yourself to really feel confident that you were getting out alive?
I felt confident when they announced that we were leaving Iraqi airspace and entering Saudi Arabian airspace. Up until then, I was really afraid that some little nest of anti-aircraft guys would see this big, fat, juicy Swiss Air jetliner and think, well, let's get them. So I felt wonderful when the guy said, we're now in Saudi Arabian airspace.
How well have you recovered from your injuries?
I've really recovered all my physical capabilities, except my little finger. It's still stiff, but I can hold reins and I can operate. And everything else, I can run, I can do push-ups and chin-ups and all the things I'd like to do.
It's kind of remarkable.
Well, hard work and good surgery and good luck.
Did they have to reset your arms?
Well, they did reset them, and they put a rod in my left arm so that I could use it earlier. Mm-hmm. And they had to, they operated on my finger. And then about 6 weeks after all that, when my arms were good enough to work again, I got my knee repaired, so I'd had a reconstruction of my right knee.
Mm-hmm. There is a possibility now of renewed fighting in the Gulf. How would you feel about the possibility of being involved militarily with Iraq again?
Well, I have to tell you that there is a regulation that says returned prisoners of war can't go back to the same theater of operations that they were captured in. So none of the prisoners of war from the Gulf War are going to go back. If we had a war in a different part of the world, I would certainly be more than willing to go.
Mm-hmm. A thought that you had that you express in the book that really kind of surprised me, when you were taken captive, you had your ring around your neck with your dog tags because you knew that if an arm or a hand is injured, there could be a lot of swelling and it would be hard to get the ring off, and the ring might actually...
It could necrose off your finger, so I knew that was the wrong answer.
Yeah, right. So you had it around your neck instead of on your finger. And so when you were taken captive, they took your ring as well as your identification. And you were thinking that maybe your husband would be disappointed you hadn't swallowed the ring. Do you think that's really what he would have wanted you to do?
Well, I know that's what he would have wanted me to do if I could have. We had talked about if he had to eject, like over the ocean, and your fingers shrink in cold water, that he would... If he could, he would swallow his. And said, even if they find me dead, make sure you x-ray my stomach before you bury me, you'll get my ring back. So we had talked about it, and I knew that would be a right thing to do. With two broken arms, I couldn't get it off the chain. I couldn't do it. I knew he wouldn't be angry. I guess I was disappointed in myself. I don't know what I was. I was very sad that they took it. I was very angry they took it.
I realized that the symbolism that it would have had to swallow the ring, but wouldn't that have been potentially, like, really bad for you physically? You were going through so much. I mean, to have a foreign object like that might have had some, difficult-to-digest parts.
Oh, I wouldn't have been digested at all. I would have just probably stayed there. No, it actually, as long as I could swallow it without having it stuck in my esophagus, I would have been fine.
Really?
Yeah.
It's okay to keep a ring in your intestines?
Well, I don't recommend that to people with small children, but uh-huh. But yeah, I probably would have been fine.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Major Rhonda Cornum, who was taken prisoner of war during the Gulf War, and there's a new book about that called She Went to War. I'm wondering if you think that one outcome of your experience as a prisoner of war was to show people, I don't mean an intentional outcome, but just one unintentional result, was to show people that a woman could take it. Do you know what I mean? That you can...
Oh, I think that's really true. That's a nice byproduct of an otherwise bad experience. I mean, I certainly wish that we had successfully launched in there, picked up this guy, and launched back. No one would have ever heard of me or the 229th Helicopter Battalion, but it would have been the best thing that could have happened. Unfortunately, that didn't occur. We lost five people on that mission. And I guess I'm grateful that something good came of it.
Mm-hmm. When you were in prison and had plenty of time to think, did you ever say to yourself, why did I do this? You know, why here I am a prisoner, my daughter is probably worried sick. Why did I leave her?
Well, I did worry about how was she dealing with that. I knew she'd be worried. I certainly didn't feel guilty about it. I think you need to make that decision about whether what you're doing is worth the disadvantages, and that's certainly being separated from your family. You need to make that decision before you join the military. And I had made that one. So whether it's a foreign correspondent going off to some dangerous place or a non-combat position just going off to be deployed on an unaccompanied tour to Korea, you need to make that decision about whether separation is worth it, whether the benefits that you see in the military, the pride or the satisfaction or whatever it is, whether it's worth it to you. And if it isn't, then you probably shouldn't join or you should put off having children.
It sounds like you really were able to not be overwhelmed by emotion.
Well, I think that's true. I think I'm pretty emotional, but I think I can compartmentalize well enough to be emotional when it's appropriate.
And being emotional is not appropriate when you're sitting in a prison.
Absolutely not. It's not helpful. I think being able to think clearly is important. It's just like when I get to a crash site of an aircraft. You have to take care of the people who are injured. You have to take care of the people who are dead. And that's not the time to question, you know, why did this happen? How horrible? I feel horrible for the families. When you're done with the job, yeah, you go home and you feel horrible about it. And you go to memorial services, you cry. But you have to compartmentalize those things until it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember seeing the TV footage of you walking off the plane. Actually, there's even a picture of that on the cover of your book. And I think our listeners will remember you were walking off the plane. You couldn't salute because both of your arms were in slings and in casts and so on. What were you thinking as you walked off the plane and everybody was watching?
I was thinking how terribly embarrassing it would be to fall as I was coming down those stairs.
Oh, because your leg was
still
bone.
Because my leg wasn't working. So I made sure there was somebody in front of me who would catch me if I fell. I didn't know how many people were out there, but there were an awful lot of cameras. And I thought how embarrassing it would be to fall into freedom.
Had you thought about the option of asking someone to support you as you were? It's not like you could really hold on to a banister.
No, I certainly couldn't. In fact, they asked me if I wanted like a wheelchair or something, and I said, you got to be kidding me. I have walked all over Iraq. I'm not going to look like a wuss getting off this airplane.
But you didn't even want somebody walking down with you, supporting you?
Well, there wasn't any room for that.
Uh-huh.
And there was nothing they could hold on to. If they held on to my arms, it hurt, and they could re-break them, so I wasn't going to have them do that. I'll take my chances with falling.
Right. Well, you didn't fall.
I did not fall, ever.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Major Rhonda Cornum. Her new book is She Went to War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with F. Chenille Jose, a writer at the center of Filipino literary, political, and cultural life. He runs what's been described as Manila's hippest bookstore. He's also defended free speech in his country as the founder of the Philippines chapter of PEN, the International Writers Organization. One of his books has just been published in America. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Unforgiven, the new Western starring Clint Eastwood and Gene Hackman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. A UN official reports mass starvation in Somalia. The leader of a United Nations technical team has been assessing the famine in the war-torn country. Catherine Bond filed this report for the BBC.
Mr. Peter Hansen said Baidoa was like the land of the dead. People don't even have the basic needs of human existence, he said. And I'm not talking about decent existence. I'm talking about survival. He said his colleagues had seen dead bodies lying in shelters too flimsy to be described even as huts. Many of the people who are there today, he said, won't be there tomorrow, adding that although aid agencies were doing an admirable job, more action was needed. One of the things the team will look into is the practicality of emergency airlifts to specific towns like Baidoa. Unlike Ethiopia in the 1984 famine, Somalia has no authoritative government. On the whole, in Ethiopia, food aid went where it was supposed to. Amid Somalia's anarchy, it's being looted, sometimes on a massive scale.
Catherine Bond reporting for the BBC. In Los Angeles, a judge has canceled the October trial date for a police officer accused of beating Rodney King. The judge indicated he will probably dismiss the criminal charge against Lawrence Powell if the federal government proceeds with its case against the officer. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Officer Powell faces charges in criminal court on one count of excessive force. The Simi Valley jury that found four Los Angeles police officers not guilty on all other charges deadlocked on a single count against Lawrence Powell. On Tuesday, a federal grand jury indicted Powell, along with the three other officers, on federal civil rights charges. The U.S. Department of Justice plans a vigorous prosecution. Today, the judge hearing the retrial in Powell's criminal case said, quote, I don't think it's in anyone's interest to have three trials on the same subject matter involving the same defendant. He ordered lawyers back to court next week to argue on the issue of dismissing the criminal charge. Powell's lawyer said today, I am pleased and somewhat surprised by the judge's action, adding, the federal prosecution has derailed the state case. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
Another team of UN inspectors arrived in Baghdad today to search for evidence of Iraqi weapons. Iraq warned yesterday that it would stop the UN personnel from inspecting government ministries. The alert raised concern that there would be a new confrontation, like the one in which inspectors waited outside the agriculture ministry for 3 weeks. Today, the team leader would not say what locations he plans to search. He said he has the right to visit any place in Iraq, but is not looking for a confrontation. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials losing 8 points in heavy trading. This is NPR. President Bush said today he's pleased with the small drop in the unemployment rate last month, but added that more jobs need to be created. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The jobless rate was down to 7.7%, a drop of 0.1%, thanks in large part to the 200,000 new jobs created last month. But 1/3 of those are temporary summer jobs, and Mr. Bush acknowledged that more needs to be done.
I simply cannot be satisfied until every American that wants a job has one. And we must work to ensure that economic growth is strong enough to bring unemployment down rapidly.
Mr. Bush said low interest rates and low inflation are good signs of an improving economy, but he said conditions are not yet perfect.
And yes, the economy has grown too slowly, but it has been anemically growing. And now this is fairly good news, you see.
But most experts say the economy is not likely to improve dramatically enough to help the president's re-election bid come November. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The Labor Department says the unemployment rate improved slightly in July, with the summer federal jobs program accounting for much of that change. It's taken 24 years, but inspectors in Geneva today agreed on a final draft of a treaty banning chemical weapons. The accord will go into effect when at least 65 nations have signed. It would eliminate chemical weapons over 10 years and provide for inspectors to make sure the agreement is obeyed. Some nations object to a provision of the treaty allowing challenge inspections. That procedure would allow any country to call for an inspection of any other country that has signed the treaty. No other global arms control pact has ever used the technique. Those countries opposed to it say it would allow unfair spying on legitimate secret activities. The UN Secretary General said today he plans to send 30 people to be permanent observers in South Africa. Boutros-Boutros-Ghali said UN representatives could mediate disputes and help ease the transition to democracy. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. My guest has been at the center of literary and political life in the Philippines. F. Chenil Jose is one of the Philippines' most celebrated writers. He also runs the best bookshop in Manila. He's opposed censorship as the founder of his country's chapter of PEN, the International Writers Organization. And with his magazine, Solidarity, he's created a forum for Asian writers to discuss politics and the arts. His best-known work in the Philippines is the Rosales Saga, about a family of settlers thrown off their land by members of the Filipino elite. This actually happened to Jose's own family before he was born. They ended up landless agricultural workers. For the first time, one of Jose's books has been published in the United States. Random House has just brought out his novellas, Three Filipino Women. And next year, they'll begin publication of his series, The Rosales Saga. We spoke to him earlier today from Manila and asked if he'd always wanted to be published in the States.
Oh, a long time ago, that was in the 50s when I first went there. I went there and showed my manuscript to the late Malcolm Cowley, and he liked it very much. And we went to New York, and we saw Anne Watkins, the literary agent, and she also liked it too. Then they made suggestions, you know, on how I should redo it. So I went home very anxious to follow their instructions. And then it occurred to me, you know, that I wasn't writing for Americans, that my audience was right here at home. So that really sort of made me, I think, a Filipino writer.
Is literature important in the Philippines? Do a lot of people read, and do a lot of people read serious literature?
Very good question. You know, our national hero, Jose Rizal, you know, wrote two novels, and these novels sort of inspired the Filipinos to revolt against Spain. They're very good Victorian novels. Unfortunately, we are a nation of non-novel enthusiasts.
So who reads your books in the Philippines?
I sell quite a lot at home because most of my books are used in the high schools and in the colleges for outside reading material. And then also because I've been in this racket for such a long time, that's the kind of following, you know.
Mm-hmm. You are a publisher, an editor, a writer, and a bookstore owner. Did the way that you see your role in the Philippines change after the Marcos regime ended?
No, because even during the Marcos regime, even if it was very tough on me and my friends, you know, economically, you know, and psychologically, we managed. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm a little bit nostalgic about the Marcos regime because the writers then had someone to fight, you know, and we're sort of united. See, now it's each one for himself, and we have failed to use the freedom that we have regained, not only in terms of better writing. You know, Marcos said something very interesting. You know, he really didn't go after writers because he knew that Filipinos do not read. He went after movie people, you know, and the journalists, you know, who had a wider audience rather than the creative writers.
You founded in 1958 the Philippines branch of PEN, the International Writers Organization, which works for free speech for writers. What motivated you to organize a Philippines chapter of PEN?
Well, what happened was I happened to be in London in 1955, you know, and I got to meet the international pen secretary there, David Kerver. He's dead. Oh, incidentally, that was the year that I also went to the United States and got to meet some of your very famous writers like Robert Frost and, as I told you, Malcolm Cowley. In any case, when I got back, I felt that it was perhaps good for us also to be a member of the International Pen Club, and that's what I did. Good in the sense that it opened for us exchanges with writers not only in the region but all over the world.
Do you think writers in the Philippines were very isolated?
Yes, in a sense, yes. But at the same time, the influence of the United States, you know, its literature is very strong here. You know, the literary fads that have swept the United States for the last 30 years also reached our shores, or rather belatedly, the new criticism, all that sort of thing. You know, for instance, there are many Filipino writers who are more familiar with the stories that come out in the New Yorker than the stories that are published locally.
Are you one of those writers?
Am I one of those writers?
Yeah, who's more busy reading the New Yorker than local literature?
No, heaven forbid.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I don't like the New Yorker stories at all.
Why not?
Oh, they're not stories. You know, nothing happens. And much of the literature, I think, that's coming out of the United States now, you know, is very trivial. The trivia of suburbia, I would call it. Don't get me wrong, I've always appreciated American literature, particularly that period that was the New England Renaissance, you know. The writers in the United States who appeal to me now are the Jewish and the black writers. You know, there's a certain melancholy to what they write that I cannot find in many of the contemporary writers in the United States.
I want to get back to when you founded the Filipino chapter of PEN, the International Writers Organization. What were the issues then for writers in the Philippines?
Oh, several. One was the nationalist issue, because even now I feel that we are not nationalist enough. I know that nationalism is a dirty word in many other countries, you know, but this is a different place altogether. We Filipinos have become very alienated from our own society.
So where do you see writers fitting into your feelings that there needs to be more nationalism, a greater sense of nationalism in the Philippines?
I attribute the lack of it to the overriding and sometimes stifling American influence on our own culture. You know, you are so pervasive, you know. If you come to Manila, you will really know what I mean. God, everywhere, Coca-Cola signs, you know.
On some level, you must have mixed feelings about that, because I know that you've read so much American literature over the years and that American literature means a lot to you.
Oh, of course it does. As a matter of fact, my greatest inspiration is that period when your writers were freeing themselves from the European romantic tradition to celebrate America, you know, Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, Emerson, all these American greats, you know. They're my idols.
But you think that's what Filipinos need to do, too, to kind of separate themselves from the people who ruled them?
Yes. This is what I'm saying, you know, that we also need to move away from this stifling American influence on our culture, because otherwise we will not be able to produce something that is ours. It will always be derivative, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frankie Chenille Jose, one of the Philippines' leading writers, publishers, editors, and bookstore owners. And his first book to be published in the United States has just been released. It's called Three Filipino Women. It's three novellas. And we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Joining us by phone from the Philippines is Frankie Chonil Jose, a writer, publisher, editor, bookstore owner, and also founder of the Philippine chapter of PEN, the International Writers Organization. Now, growing up poor as an agricultural worker, how did books get to be important in your life?
Oh, my mother encouraged me to read. You know, in that little village where I was born, you know, I was always with books. She'd go around the town looking for books for me to read, you know. And there were instances when we didn't have a light in the house because the kerosene lamp was empty. So I'd walk to the far corner and read late into the night under the electric street lamp.
So you had to read outside?
Yes, yes.
Did your mother approve of that, or did she try to get you back home?
Oh, when by about midnight, she'd tell me to go back home and sleep, you know. The first novels I read were the novels of Rizal. And then I read Willa Cather's My Antonia. That's the third novel I read.
And what effect did that have on you?
Oh, very much. I was very impressed by it, you know. For many years, I believed that Willa Cather was a man, you know. And then I read Don Quixote, too. You know, that's a very thick book. These are the first four novels I've read.
You've written some stories about the choice between pursuing wealth or pursuing one's ideals. Has that ever been a choice for you, a dilemma that you've been faced with?
Let me put it this way. I've always wanted to be very rich.
Well, actually, you once said you wanted to be very rich, but writing about the poor.
Oh, I said that too. But in this country, you cannot get rich writing books.
Now, at the same time that you would really like to be rich, you've written a lot about the elites who have oppressed the Filipino people. Who are those elites now? Have those elites changed recently?
A shortcut to achieving wealth in this country is through politics, you know, because once you are politically powerful, it goes without saying that you can do almost anything you like the way Marcos did it, see? Now, there's old money here too, but a lot of this old money, especially those who have great fortunes. I can only recall, I think it was Balzac who said it, that behind every great fortune is a great crime.
In your novella, Platinum, one of the characters quotes a now famous saying, although I can't remember who originally said it. He says, if one is not a communist when one is 18, he has no heart. If he's still a communist at 40, he has no head. Do you think your politics have changed as you've gotten older? You're approaching 70 now.
Yeah, three more years and I'll be 70. Isn't that sad, huh? Well, no, I'm still hoping for a nationalist revolution. I'm still very much a populist. I still think that what this country needs is good Marxist analysis, but non-Marxist solutions to its problems. And in a sense, you know, I still feel very, very young with my ideals.
How did you start writing? You left college to take a job, but how did you end up writing?
Well, I wanted to be a doctor because I was in the medical corps during the war. You know, but I wasn't very good in biochemistry. I flunked it. So I had to do the next best thing, you know, to earn a living as a writer, and that's what I did. I went into journalism after I flunked medical school.
Were you glad that that's how it ended up?
Oh, no. You see, I've always wanted to be a doctor, and even now I'm a frustrated doctor, you know. As a matter of fact, when I failed, I almost committed suicide.
Really?
Yeah. A traumatic experience.
Well, you would have made a lot more money as a doctor.
Well, you see, from the very beginning, I knew I wasn't going to be rich, you know, so it's enough that I'd be comfortable.
Right.
Long time ago, I made that decision, you know, because when I was in journalism and I wrote this down in one of my stories, I could have easily become an executive of one of the biggest companies in this country, you know. And I sometimes tell my kids, if I got the job in 1950, we'd be vacationing in Europe every year and I'd be playing golf, you know.
But that's not what happened.
No, because that offer was given to me in the 50s.
So you turned down that offer?
I turned it down.
Why?
Well, I decided that it was more fun being a writer. I'd get more self-satisfaction. And being a writer provides me more honesty with myself. You see, when you get into work in a big corporation, especially this corporation where I was supposed to be in, I'd have to be a hypocrite, you know. I'd even have to learn Spanish, you know.
What would be wrong about learning Spanish?
Well, it's not bad, but because it's the language of the Filipino elite, you know. But the reason is, why should I?
When was the last time you went back to the village where you grew up?
Oh, every so often, you know, I go back to this village sometimes when I'm on my way to the north. It's a kind of pilgrimage when I want to look back, to remember, to draw sustenance from this wellspring. I go there, I drop by and look at the place. It has deteriorated so much, it has now become an urban slum, you know, and the friends of my childhood who are still very much alive, I look at them and see them so old and so defeated, you know, and I ask myself every so often why I was able to free myself from that village and why they haven't been able to do so. Aside from that, I like listening to my own language, you know, because my language is beautiful, and I'm really sorry that I can't use it anymore, but I still try to use equivalent phrases and idioms and terms, you know, in English as much as I can.
F. Chenille Jose spoke with us from Manila. His book, Three Filipino Women, has just been published in the States by Random House. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Sylvia Pajoli reports on refugee accounts coming from camps in northern Bosnia. An Amnesty International USA spokesman reminds us about the Geneva Convention rules regarding detention camps, regarding prisoners of war and civilians as well. Deborah Amos updates us on the newest weapons inspection efforts in Iraq and about the U.S. demand of total access. Also, we'll talk with producer Warrington Hudlin, a producer along with his brother Reginald of several films, including Eddie Murphy's latest Boomerang. He talks about their new animated feature. It's called Bebe's Kids, based on a comedy routine by the late Robin Harris.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Until just a few years ago, Clint Eastwood was regarded as a sure thing at the box office. That was before he made such flops as Pink Cadillac, The Rookie, and White Hunter Black Heart. His latest film, the 16th he directed himself, is called Unforgiven, and it's pretty risky, a Western that's 2 hours and 10 minutes long. Film critic Stephen Schiff took a look.
I don't know whether Unforgiven will be a box office hit, but I do know this. It's Clint Eastwood's masterpiece, the finest film he's ever directed, and the best Western anyone has made in at least a dozen years. No one could possibly film a Western these days without being a little bit revisionist and self-conscious. And sure enough, Unforgiven is a Western about Westerns, particularly about the mystique of six-shooters and gunmen and violence. Eastwood plays Will Money, once among the most feared killers ever to come out of Missouri, but now an aging and not very successful hog farmer. His beloved wife, who helped reform him, has just died, leaving him to raise their two kids. But the hogs are sick and the sun is hot, and on the horizon lies one last adventure. In the little Wyoming town of Big Whiskey, a cowpoke has flown into a rage and slashed the face of a prostitute. Now the other prostitutes are offering $1,000 to anyone who will kill the slasher and his pal. Will Money can barely remember how to get on a horse, but the temptation of all that cash is too great. He takes along his old partner, Ned, played by Morgan Freeman, and a hot-to-trot youngster who calls himself the Schofield Kid, played by James Wolvet, and he heads for Big Whiskey. What he doesn't know is that law and order are being maintained there by another ex-killer, a peace-loving but sadistic sheriff named Little Bill Daggett. He's played by Gene Hackman in a beautiful performance that's typical of this movie's richness and complexity. Nothing in Unforgiven is black and white. Even the slasher isn't truly evil. Hackman's Little Bill begins as a likable and refreshingly straightforward character, but he winds up as a mesmerizing villain, and the movie builds inexorably to the final confrontation between him and Will Money. It begins like this, with two reformed killers stripping away the veneer of restraint and civilization to reveal the angels of death they've always been and always will be.
You'd be William Money out of Missouri. Kill women and children. That's right. I've killed women and children. Killed just about everything that walks or crawls at one time or another. And I'm here to kill you, Little Bill. For what you did to Ned. Boys better move away.
All right, gentlemen. He's got one barrel left. When he fires that, take out your pistols and shoot him down like the mangy scoundrel he is.
Eastwood's performance here is by turns poignant and terrifying. This is his best acting ever, but then Unforgiven is full of bests. Eastwood has never gathered such a superb ensemble of actors around him, and he's never worked from such a terrific screenplay before. It was written by David Webb Peoples. Eastwood tells his story in a grand and beautiful arc, beginning in blistering sunshine and ending in cold darkness and rain. And the webbing supporting that arc is made up of 1,000 carefully spun oppositions between the Madonna-like wife who reformed Will Money and the vengeful prostitutes who lure him back to the gun, between the trigger-happy Schofield Kid, who knows nothing of death, and the trigger-shy Will and Ned, who know too much. Most remarkable of all is the way Eastwood demystifies the Western without demythifying it. He makes every scene feel rough, unglamorous, and real, and yet, in the end, he allows us to hold on to the myth of the gunman in all its bleak majesty. He knows that the movies depend not on truth or on legend alone, but on a subtly convincing mixture of the two. With Unforgiven, the highest pantheon of the great American movie genre expands. To the list of John Ford, Howard Hawks, Anthony Mann, and Sam Peckinpah, now add Clint Eastwood.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, after The Thin Blue Line, filmmaker Errol Morris has just completed a documentary on the esteemed physicist Stephen Hawking. Hawking has ALS, a degenerative disease that has all but immobilized his body while leaving his brilliant mind unharmed. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.